The Jonathan Cruz case was hastily investigated by authorities, but many questions remain. Come behind the curtain with private investigator Sheila Wysocki as she uncovers the truth about what happened to Jonathan. This is Without Warning. Warning: the following episode contains elements that are graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
In the last episode, you heard a breakdown of the 911 call. Remember, the call has been analyzed by statement analysis experts and 911 call experts. The consensus based on evidence is the 911 call has deception. The consensus was also that the 911 operator was not well trained. So let's go through the first 24 hours of Jonathan's case. You all heard the 911 call. Here are the simple facts from the call. Jonathan was shot. There were two people in the apartment at the time Jonathan died. One of them pulled the trigger. Since Jonathan is dead, he can't tell his story, but Brenda is telling one. In this episode, you will hear from Jonathan's family, Pam, John, and Danny. You will hear what they remembered about the night Jonathan died. Families talking about the death of their loved one is very painful. Families try to forget circumstances surrounding the death of their loved one and celebrate their life. The Cruz family is no different. They don't want to remember just the night Jonathan died. They want to celebrate Jonathan's life and how he was with his friends and family to society, and what he meant to the family and friends and to society. Once again, I've asked the Cruz family to step out of their comfort zone and talk to me and let you hear their story. Pam Cruz.
The night of February 2nd was Super Bowl Sunday, and we had had some friends over to watch the game with us. So Danny and I taped Downton Abbey, which we had been, that was our thing every Sunday night. We kind of snuggle up and watch that together. So it was pretty late that night by the time we got to bed. And instead of watching on the couch, we decided to watch in my bedroom. And since she did not want to crawl up the bed with her dad in there too, she made a little pallet next to my side of the bed. And we turned on Downton Abbey. It had just started when she got a phone call. And what I heard was somebody scream, "He's dead," and then a lot of other noise. It was a wailing, "He's dead." And so I immediately said, "Is she talking about Jonathan?" Because everybody else in our family was there in the house. And Danny kind of waved me off, like, you know, don't keep talking. But I must have kept talking. I don't remember talking, but I know that she got up and left the room. And I followed her, but she went out and shut the door.
Danny Cruz.
So I was in my parents' room, and I was on the floor. We were turning on Downton Abbey, and I got a call from Brenda, and it was 11:42, which I thought was kind of a weird time for her to be calling. So I answered the phone call, and she immediately started screaming. And I couldn't really understand what she was saying because she was talking so loudly and quickly. And so I thought that, because he had told me that he was going to break up with her, and she had been complaining for several months that her car was imminently going to break down. So I thought that in some horrible twist of fate, he'd broken up with her when they were at his apartment, and she tried to start a car and couldn't, and she was so hysterical because she couldn't get home. So I asked her if she needed me to come pick her up, and she said yes. So I started to walk out of my parents' room, and then she said, he's dead. And I asked, who's dead? And she said, Jonathan.
And in my mind, I thought, as soon as I heard he's dead, I guess you try to reconcile things in your mind. I thought, well, Jonathan has had an accident in his new car. He bought a car that was a little bit smaller than I would have liked him to buy. It was a normal size car, but I would have liked him in a tank. And so in my mind, I thought Jonathan's had an accident in the new car, but he's just unconscious or something. Brenda's made a mistake. He's not dead. He's just hurt. He'll be fine. But about then, Danny came back in the room, and she said, Brenda says that Jonathan shot himself.
So then I tried to clarify, but she just started screaming again. And then I told my parents what was going on, and we all just rushed out.
And I turned to John, who was still laying in the bed, and I said, Brenda says Jonathan shot himself. And he made this horrible noise, almost like an animal that had been shot or something. He got up and he just ran from the bed, ran to his closet and grabbed something and headed for the car. And Danny ran right after him.
My dad and I hopped in the car. I remember, like, throwing Christian's door open and yelling, we need to get to Jonathan's apartment. And so my dad and I hopped in the car and we just went.
Christian showed up in our room about that time, I guess hearing all the commotion. And I told him, Brenda says that Jonathan has shot himself. And Christian waited with me so that I wouldn't be having to go alone. Danny and John were just gone. So I threw on sweats. It took me maybe 30 seconds to a minute. And we were right behind him out the door. Took my car over there. On the way over, I started trying to make sense of what I'd heard and trying to figure out what could have possibly happened. And I just went through a mental checklist of all the areas of Jonathan's life because it just didn't compute that he would do something like that. So I was trying to figure out if there was anything I might have missed that I didn't understand about him or, you know, what would make that happen. And I went through all the areas. I thought about his job. And no, he was doing so well. He was so happy at work. He had just gotten an unexpected raise that they, when he went in and asked, why is my paycheck bigger? They said, you're doing such a good job. We just thought you needed a raise. He had been given a lot of money to upgrade his clinic, which had been kind of a one the company wasn't willing to pour money into, but Jonathan had turned around so well that they had given him money to upgrade the clinic. So I knew there was nothing wrong with his job. He loved his coworkers. He was always talking about them. Really enjoyed going to work. You know, I thought about Brenda. I knew there had been an earlier conflict. I think he told me maybe in December or so, when he went out to dinner with Emily and Jacob, he had told me, you know, I might not be able to continue dating her because of her jealousy. But he had not kept filling me in the meantime, so I didn't know that was an ongoing issue. So I thought, well, there's nothing there. And he was so excited about his new apartment. I knew that was really exciting for him. He had his new car. And so pretty quickly I had determined that there was really no reason. There's just no way that Jonathan could have done something like that. So I decided in my mind I would just give the police a little test when I got there. I decided that probably what had happened was that an intruder had come into the house to rob it, and Jonathan would have definitely fought back if somebody came into his house, and so they probably shot him, and that Brenda found him and thought that he had done that because there was nobody else there. So I decided I would ask the police where Jonathan had been shot, because after so many years of our martial arts training, and not just martial arts, but street fighting training, just very well-rounded gun, stick, knife, all kinds of defenses and offenses that we had learned. We knew where the vulnerable points in body were. I knew that there was no way that Jonathan would shoot himself in the body. And I thought, intruders shoot you in the body, you shoot yourself in the head. So I thought I would just ask the police where he's been shot, and if it was in the body, that would be my absolute confirmation. So we pulled up to the apartment, and there were just emergency vehicles everywhere. It must have been every emergency vehicle in Coppell. It's not a big town, but at that moment when I saw all of the emergency vehicles, all those little things I was playing over in my head to tell myself that he would be fine, that there had been some misunderstanding, that kind of went right out the window right there. My heart just sunk. I knew that something really terrible had happened. So we pulled up. We managed to be able to park pretty close to Jonathan's apartment.
And then my mom and Christian followed behind. And we got there first, my dad and me. And so we hopped out and started talking to the police officer because, there were officers everywhere. There was a fire truck. There was everything. And so we hopped out and started talking to the guy, and he said that, we couldn't go in or anything, but he confirmed that he was dead. And then my mom and brother got there, and I don't really remember a ton of what happened after that. It was just a huge, chaotic blur. I do remember asking the police if they were going to shoot Ulysses, because they said that Ulysses wouldn't let them near him. And the guy said, no, we're not going to do that.
Christian and I got out of the car, and I saw that John was more over where Jonathan's apartment was, and Danielle got out of John's car and approached Christian and me when she saw that we were there. I learned later John had told her just stay in the car until he found out what was going on. But we walked over to the police officer, and the first thing the police officer did was say that I couldn't go into the apartment. And I told him that was fine because I knew that I couldn't live if I had seen my son in some terrible predicament or, very wounded. I knew that that was something I couldn't do. And then I asked him, can you tell me if he was shot in the head or in the body? And the officer said he was shot in the body. And I said, Jonathan didn't do this. I said he would never shoot himself. But he absolutely wouldn't shoot himself in the body. Somebody else did this. And then the officer asked, who had taken the phone call from Brenda. And Danielle said it was her, so he asked if he could speak with her alone. So Christian and I went back and got in the car. And Danny came in just very shortly later. He must have not had very many questions for her. He wanted to know kind of what Brenda had said during the call. And then he said something weird to me, Mom. And I asked what he had said, and she said, this is not something Jonathan did to himself on purpose. And so I thought, well, that's odd. I already knew that, but somehow they knew from the evidence that this was not an intentional gunshot wound. And so we went off and, started to go back home because there was just really nothing to do there. You kind of just want to run in circles. It's weird. There must be some adrenaline, but we just decided to go home. John stayed there for quite a while. He just didn't want to leave Jonathan. But on the way home, I called our pastor, who was my best friend and John's best friend at that time, and I called Henry Sue to tell him that Jonathan had been shot and Brenda had been there. So we got home, and it seemed like not very long later, a lot of people from church started showing up, and pretty soon we just had a room full of people there. And then Henry Sue called and asked if he might be able to come over too. So we were all just sitting in the family room. I don't remember a lot of the conversation, but I do remember that many times, many different people said, that girl must have shot him because Jonathan would never shoot himself. And people just kept saying that. I got a little embarrassed because I knew Henry was very close to Brenda, very protective of her. So I thought he might be offended. So I just said, well, we should wait and see what the police say before we accuse anybody. And right away he said, almost with an angry tone, he said, that's right. So clearly he had been offended by people suggesting that. Eventually, oh, I should say, also by that time, I had then been informed John was home and told me that Brenda had been in the house when Jonathan was shot. So even though I really didn't understand why, it was kind of in my mind that she may have had something to do with this. And I assumed that the police would figure that out pretty quickly and that the next call we got might be that they had arrested Brenda for shooting him. So we just let that go, and I thought that's what I was expecting. But I didn't want to say it in front of anybody, you know, until I thought we'd just wait and let them tell us. But everybody eventually left, and Henry called us somewhere in the middle of the night. We had finally all fallen asleep. I think the whole family was in my room. Nobody wanted to be apart from each other. We just didn't know what to do. So we all came into my room. Everybody fell asleep. And then Henry Sue called somewhere in the middle of the night. John answered and handed the phone to me. I spoke with Henry, although John said he was able to overhear the entire conversation. And Henry told me about how he had picked Brenda up at the police station, taken her to get something to eat, and then drove her to her house. I believe she lived in Garland. I'm not sure. Maybe Grand Prairie. But he said, she told me what happened. Would you like to know? And I said, yes. And so he told me about their day, kind of how they'd argued off and on. They'd had some dinner, gone to bed, and that they continued to argue, and Brenda had gotten mad at Jonathan, so she went into the bathroom. And he said eventually she came out of the bathroom, but she was still mad at Jonathan, so she went and sat in the living room. And while she was in the living room, she suddenly heard Jonathan yell out, "Cover your ears," and then she heard a gunshot. And that she ran into the room at that point and found that Jonathan was already shot. And somehow those words, she found that he was already shot. I don't know why, but in that moment it struck me. It was just weird. But those were the exact words he used.
While you're thinking about that, let's take a commercial break.
The next morning, then somebody came to get me. Somebody from our church came back to the house, and I remember she came up even I was in bed, and she woke me up and kind of got me up and took me to my doctor so that I could get some sleeping pills and some sedatives and just something to be able to survive. You know, it's impossible to explain what you feel like, but I could not have gone on the way I was. So she took me down there. And John went over to the police station. He just kept wanting to be over where either where Jonathan was or where that he could find out what had happened. And he went to the police station. He came back and he told me that it was really weird. The police had said something to him, which he may be able to articulate in more exact words, but it was something to the effect of, you should at least know that this was not something Jonathan intended to have happen. And we didn't quite know where to put that. You know, we really at this point were so confused. We had no idea what had happened. Henry had told me during the phone call the night before that they had questioned Brenda and swabbed her hands for gunpowder and then let her go. So to me, not understanding quite how the process worked of that kind of hand testing, I thought that they tested it and they would be able to tell right away whether they had shot, that she had shot a gun. And since they let her go, I thought that they were saying she had not shot a gun. So we were left just with this swirling confusion, knowing that Jonathan would not have shot himself, knowing that, or believing that Brenda had not shot a gun. There was just this mass confusion. And so the next thing I told myself was there must have been some weird accident. But even that didn't make sense because Jonathan was always so incredibly careful with his guns. There had been an incident just, gosh, within the week that he moved out of my house. Before he left, he wanted everything so perfect for his apartment. He oiled the furniture he was taking before he took it. He got everything prepared so that his new place would be beautiful once whatever it was got in there. So he and Danielle decided that he should clean all of his guns before he took them over there. And I came in the house one afternoon, just, you know, probably within 2 weeks of the time Jonathan was killed. And they had taken apart all of his guns, and they were all laying across my kitchen island, all with the, the barrel of the gun. Every gun was facing the same way. They were all facing the back of the kitchen, away from Jonathan and Danielle. And they were completely taken apart. So when I wanted to speak to them, I walked around the island so I could see their faces, as you'd like to do, you know, when I was speaking with them. And Jonathan immediately got very upset with me. He told me that to get out of there right away and not to be standing over there. And, you know, that it wasn't safe to stand facing the barrel of a gun ever. And I told him, well, Jonathan, these guns are all so taken apart, they couldn't, there's no way any of these guns could fire. And he said, I don't care. You never get in front of the barrel of a gun. So that was how over the top careful he was. So the idea that he was waving a gun around or anything, it just was inconceivable to me. And I just was just, it added to my confusion. I was just bewildered and confused for such a long time. And every time I'd try to put all the pieces together, I just couldn't do it. So I, kind of like Scarlett O'Hara, I guess, I would always think, well, I'll think about this tomorrow and try and figure it out. It was like when I look back, it was like trying to figuring out a math problem in your head that's really hard, and you can get to a certain point, but then you just can't go any further. I don't know if you've ever done that, but that's how it felt to me. And so deciding that the police didn't think Brenda had shot him, the only thing I was left really with was that there was some accident that I couldn't quite figure out yet. And so I decided that what I needed to do was just take care of all the young people in my house. I was trying to take care of Christian. I was trying to take care of Danielle. And then Brenda showed up at our house the day, kind of midday, on the Monday after Jonathan was killed. And she was acting like she was just so victimized and so traumatized by this whole event that I really ended up taking more care of her than anybody else. She was just commanding all the attention in the room. And so I just was making sure that she was okay. I offered to let her stay with us. I offered to pay if she wanted to go to any counseling. I just wanted to make sure that everybody was as okay as they could be. I have great kids. My kids were trying to take care of me, and I was trying to take care of Brenda. And that's kind of how it went for the first few days. My daughter told me somewhere in there, she was staying with Danny, sleeping in Danny's bed. Danny said that one day she said, Danny, do you want to know what happened? And I believe Danny was not really interested in hearing exactly what had happened at that point, but Brenda insisted on telling her that they were standing up having an argument, and all of a sudden Jonathan shot himself and fell onto the bed. So that was a different story. I didn't find out about that story for about a week, but she told Danielle that story just within the first couple of days. The other thing weird that happened during that time was that Danny said all of a sudden Brenda's old boyfriend Matthew started contacting Brenda, and Brenda told Danielle, oh, he's just trying to get back with me. Can you tell him that my boyfriend died and I'm not interested in talking to him anymore? So Danny somehow had to relay that message to Matthew, which is important for reasons that I'm sure you'll go into later. And then Brenda wanted Danielle to take her. She was very much interested in getting her purse and her car back from the police. She wanted her things back as quickly as she could get them. And so Danny took her over to the police station and managed to get those items back from her. I don't believe they took the car away from Jonathan's apartment complex. I think Danny took her over there and got the car from there. So we kind of existed there for the next few days.
John's the only one who's been up to the police station, correct?
I spoke to the police that first night. At some point, they appeared at our door, and they wanted some more items, maybe Jonathan's. I think they had his phone. They came to the door, and they wanted some kind of something that had been Jonathan's. Maybe John can tell you what that was. He was more in charge of dealing with them. He really went into action taking care of business, and I went into action sitting on the couch staring into space. I remember the police being here, but I don't remember what they took.
John Cruz.
Most people don't have, you know, a lot of direct run-ins with the criminal justice system. They don't know what to expect. And, you know, and because of that, maybe not everybody, but I think most people just kind of have a feeling, you know, this impression that if something ever happens and they need the police, they'll be there and they'll do what needs to be done. And if there's one thing that I learned from this, is that if you ever have this kind of a major tragedy in your life, you really ought to hire a professional to get in early. You should get somebody involved early and not necessarily count on what law enforcement is going to do, because you don't know what they're going to do. And, you know, here, I don't necessarily think that there were bad motives attributable to anybody, but simple things like looking at the police report from that first night is riddled with errors. And, you know, as a trial lawyer, I know that those little things, those little mistakes can make a big difference at the end of the day. And some of them weren't so little, like somebody, I don't know who, either said or implied to the police that Jonathan was on antidepressants. Totally untrue statement. And the way the report reads, you could reach the conclusion that I'm the one who said that. And I know for a fact I never said that, because as far as I know, he's never been on antidepressants. I have a suspicion that Brenda's the one who said that. But, you know, things like that, that maybe a more sophisticated department wouldn't make those kind of mistakes. But in a small town like Coppell, Texas, where they don't regularly investigate homicides or probably any kind of crime that is really serious, they just don't have that, at least in this case, didn't have, you know, that degree of sensitivity about and carefulness about, you know, how you have to handle these things. And, you know, and as an example, one of the detectives told me that I think they spent approximately 3 hours interviewing Brenda, and that several times they thought they were close to getting a confession, but it never happened. Well, I talked to another friend of mine who happens to be in law enforcement, and he said where he works, she would have been there for 8 hours or longer, because it doesn't happen in 3 hours. It takes more time than that. It takes time to build a rapport, to build that level of trust where, you know, the person finally is willing to tell the truth. And you just wonder, here we are 7 years later, just maybe this could have been done, you know, within weeks, if not months, if things had been handled a little bit differently. And it's really unfortunate.
I remember talking to you all on the telephone and then going to Coppell, getting the documents that you all had. And I remember saying to Pam, this should not take more than 3 months.
Yeah.
I remember that too.
Yeah. And it should not have taken this long.
No, that's right. And by the time we met you, and again, one of the things that's, I was both surprised at and that in retrospect is disappointing is, you know, having not really been too, I've represented criminal defendants to some extent in the past, but it's not what I do primarily. But even on the civil side, I know the kind of toll that litigation can take on a family or a person. And so, you know, being kind of acutely aware that this could be much more pronounced even than that on our family, very early on when we had those police officers who were saying, yes, this is what we believe happened. Yes, we think we can prove it. I point blank said, I need to know. I need you to give me your percentage of comfort level that you think that you can get a conviction. And I was told 90%+. And unfortunately, that was the group of detectives who were not originally involved. And even there, you wonder if they had been originally involved, if they had really dug in, could this have been solved in 3 months, 6 months, a year? Maybe so. All I know is that the first group really did not do a good job. And like I say, the police report alone, replete with errors, has my name wrong, has many details that are just wrong. And by the way, that becomes compounded because now that goes to the medical examiner. And the medical examiner, you know, again, it's the other thing I think that we get confused about as lay people. You think, oh, once it gets to the medical examiner, it's all objective, right? They're just looking at their beakers and testing things and looking at angles and things like that. But it's not really that way. They also want to know the context. And then from the context and from the physical evidence, the medical examiner makes a conclusion. And in here, if the medical examiner didn't have critical facts at the time that he determined that he couldn't determine the cause of death or the he didn't know that they had been fighting. He didn't know that she was insanely jealous. He didn't know that she had been complaining about him seeing a girl the other day. He didn't know that they were in the process of breaking up. And, you know, all those things, all those subjective things go along with the objective things, as you would expect for anybody trying to come to a conclusion as to what happened, including a medical examiner. And frankly, he was denied the opportunity to weigh those things appropriately. And it's the kind of thing where I don't think you can fix it. You can't go back 2 years and say, here's some more data. What would you have done differently? It just doesn't work that way.
You can try, but you can get what we've gotten.
That's right.
I'm going to refer it on to the DA and have him investigate. And then Coppell Police Department says, oh, no, you can't. So you have a wall that says you guys can't do what needs to be done to find justice. And I do refer to it now as the criminal justice system. It's not for the victims. It's for the criminal.
No, it is. And kind of last thing, just to clarify one point that Pam made earlier, is the police never really said, just go away, we're done. The case is officially open, but inactive. And one of the things that they had said a long time ago was, you know, fact is that there can be new evidence that comes in 5 years later, 7 years later, 20 years later, that becomes more compelling and that they can use to get a conviction. And that tells you two things. The medical examiner has not ruled out homicide, so nobody should be confused about that. That's still open. And the police department has not ruled out homicide. Both, even though they're not really, haven't really done much to help us lately, for both, that remains an open issue.
However, they will not meet with someone who has more new information like we did.
I'll tell you, it's really, again, when you kind of look at the whole picture and you just say, here are some things that are shocking about the investigation, is, for example, they didn't interview any of the people they should have interviewed. They knew who Matthew Kirk was. They knew he was a former boyfriend of Brenda. And I think they had an inkling that he might have some helpful information. But when he avoided talking to them, they did not press the issue. And if they had found out that extreme level of jealousy, it may have changed completely the way they investigated this thing.
But they didn't even get the initial things right. So what makes us think that they're going to get something like interviewing witnesses? So I'll tell you, listening today to all the different interviews and stuff, over and over, we ask, did the police contact you? Did you have any contact whatsoever? Did you call the police? Had Stephanie not called the police, they wouldn't have had that information. She
That's
lived
right.
across the hall. That should have been done that night. So it was a terrible investigation at the beginning. So
ahead.
Yeah, it really was. In fact, one kind of a perfect example of why you got to get things early is, in our case, we interviewed two different sets of friends and acquaintances of Brenda. The first ones had no knowledge of what was going to happen. They didn't understand the deposition process. And when they answered questions, they destroyed her. Not intentionally, but, you know, they admitted that she had five different versions of the events, things that just destroy somebody's credibility. Because, and we know the reason for that, because there isn't any credibility. When you can't explain the same event, you know, consistently, and there are dramatically different versions, that's really going to impact the way a jury sees your credibility. So whatever it was, 6 months later or some extended period of later, we set up depositions with another five or six, you know, people who were friends of Brenda. And interestingly, while the first set at least answered the questions and remembered things, the second set didn't remember anything. Suddenly they had all gotten amnesia, or they denied ever having had any conversations with Brenda about any of this. So somehow, I don't know how, we randomly picked six people who did have conversations with her the first time, and randomly picked six people who didn't have any conversations with her the second time. Or do you suppose that maybe they'd heard about how the first set went, understood that it didn't go very well for Brenda, and didn't want to see that mistake repeated?
So to that point, is it Payam was the one, I always get the brothers confused. Payam was the one that gave the deposition. Patron, or how do you say his name? He didn't show up, and Tom had to say, "We'll arrest you." Is that okay? Yeah. So just from that, the first deposition with the brother, Payam, to the second one where he had amnesia, shame on him.
And but the point of all this is, if you don't interview the witnesses early and quickly, nothing good can happen by waiting.
I'm going to pause for a moment for a commercial break.
Two other things maybe you should mention about the police. Now that you're talking about this, it reminds me. We found out right away that Henry Sue was telling yet a completely different version of the story. And I told the police, please get Henry Sue. He's got a different version from her. Get him before they talk and he changes his mind. And they never went and talked to him. They would have yet another version that we don't have because Henry lied in his deposition.
They have the manpower in Coppell to do it. They could have had one guy doing what I ended up doing, talking to those people. That's their job, just saying.
Yeah, and they called in Jonathan's friends, so why not call in Brenda's friends? And especially when we're telling them, this person will tell you this, get him. And they also told us right away, if it was another county besides Dallas, she would have been arrested right away.
I was just going to go down that road. Do you think because she is a pretty young lady, and that's in the eyes of the beholder, that she got away with more and they gave her a lot of leniency?
You know, I don't know. I know the first group obviously thought she did it and thought they were going to get a confession. Now, why they stopped, why they were taken off the case, why it changed, I really don't know. And the second group even seemed more anxious, you know, and were more open about where they were. Like the first group, they were a little more cautious in what they said. Although it was clear they thought that she did it, but they were more cautious in the way they expressed it. But second group was like, no, she did it, basically, you know. So I don't know. I don't know if that's what it was. I tend to think it was lack of experience.
Jonathan just has the greatest friends in the world. He was really, for the most part, other than a couple of obvious exceptions, really able to connect with really quality, wonderful, caring people. So he left us with some wonderful, his friends are our friends. They look after us. We look after them. So his friends would come by the house, especially at first. They were just so conscientious about making sure we were okay. And just very shortly after the funeral, Emily and Jacob and Caitlin came over, and they were sitting with us one day. And my sister-in-law was still here too, I remember, and I was talking to the girls, and they kind of looked at each other, and they said, should we tell her? And I said, well, now you've got to tell me. And Emily then told me about Jonathan's last day of life and how they had gone to breakfast, and Emily and Jonathan and Jacob had gone to breakfast or brunch over at Anamia's, one of our favorite restaurants. And while they were there, Brenda started just calling the phone incessantly and texting Jonathan, and she could tell Jonathan was more and more nervous and more bothered. And he had told them during that brunch that finally revealed that Brenda really did not like Emily, that she had a very big jealousy problem with Emily. And that was huge, because Jonathan had told me at the very beginning, when he had first told me about Brenda's jealousy and that he may not be able to continue dating her because she seemed excessively jealous, but he was going to give it a little bit of time. Probably mostly that was my fault, because when he told me that she was very jealous, I told him that what I knew of Brenda's last relationship was that she had been with a man for many years who mistreated her and constantly cheated on her. And I said, you know, that can have an effect on a girl where she's not really, it's hard for her to trust again. But once she sees what a wonderful, trustworthy guy you are, she may come around and start to feel safe. So I regret that probably more than anything my whole life. But that's what I knew of, you know, that's what I knew of relationships, I guess. And so he was going to give her a little more time. He told me he was not going to let Emily and Jacob know that, because he knew once they knew that, they would never like her again. And he knew at that point it would be over. He wouldn't be able to date Brenda anyway, because that'd be the end of the game once any of them didn't like each other. So he was going to give a little time and see if once Brenda saw how wonderful and non-threatening Emily was and what a really great friend she was, that maybe Brenda would start to love Emily the way Jonathan did. That was his hope. So when he took them to lunch on that last day and revealed that Brenda had this all-consuming jealousy for Emily, that was huge, because that was Jonathan knowing that the relationship was over and being willing to put that final nail in the coffin by telling Jacob and Emily what was going on. But because Emily's such a great friend, she even offered, you know, Jonathan, I know that you really care for her. Why don't I just take a step back from your life for a while and you can see how this works with Brenda, and then we'll revisit this later. And he said, no, that's not an option. He said, I'm not doing that. He said, you guys are my best friends. They can tell you better, but this is the way I remember them telling me. You're my best friends. I want to be married. I want to have children. And I want to do all those things with you. And if Brenda's the person I'm with, that just can't happen. And so he told them that he was going to break up with her that day. They took him back to the house. And they said as they were driving back, when they were driving to his apartment complex, all of a sudden he really stiffened up and looked fearful. And they asked him what was going on, and he said that he thought he'd seen Brenda's car and that she was over there and shouldn't have been. And they said, well, she wouldn't do that, would she? And he said, oh, yes, she would. So they looked a little closer and decided that it was not her car. So he invited Emily and Jacob into the house, where Jacob was able to actually give a final witness to the state of the gun, how it was that day, just before he was shot. You know, we know later that it was found with the magazine hidden under Jonathan's neckties. When Jacob saw the gun, it had the magazine in the gun, and he said that that was Jonathan's practice to keep it that way because it was there for self-defense.
Death investigations by law enforcement agencies are complicated. Crime scenes take a long time to process if done properly. Detectives should record if things are out of place or altered. Was there a struggle? Where was the victim? Most importantly, where was the firearm? Did the 911 call information match up to the crime scene? Simple things. Were the lights turned on or off? Was the door open or closed? Was the TV on or off? Detailed notes should be put in an incident report. Pictures of the crime scene should be documented inch by inch. Detectives should find and identify the evidence and, most importantly, interview witnesses, all of them. Jonathan lived in an apartment. Detectives should have gone door to door, especially if they listened to the 911 call, walk across the breezeway and knock on the doors across from Jonathan. Ask questions. The Cruz family relied on the police. They believed in the authorities and that they would do the right thing. And here they are, 7 years later, with nothing, because the first 24 hours of Jonathan's case was not processed properly. It was sloppy. And the police refused to sit down with anyone who has information. They have turned away the Texas Rangers, the DA's office. Now think about that. If that were your son, wouldn't you want to get someone in there that knew how to process a death investigation properly? Next week, let's look at the first 24 hours, the incident reports, and the police officers on the scene. Don't forget to send in your questions to Sheila at SheilaWysocki.com regarding Jonathan Cruz's case. Here is this week's question.
Hi, my name is Morgan, and I am reading for one of the listeners, Destiny, who sent in a question. And her question was, in the 911 call, it sounds like the first operator asks Brenda, "Did you mean to do it?" After listening several times, the operator is actually asking, "Did he mean to do it?" Could Brenda have thought the same as I, that she was being asked if she meant to do it? Her answer is no, and then the operator asks if he did it on purpose, and she says yes, on purpose. Has this ever been brought up?
No, it's never been brought up, but the statement analysis and the 911 experts have looked at her overall statement. They believe she was telling the truth when she said no. My favorite things this week, St. Thomas Hospital. The nurses at St. Thomas Hospitals go above and beyond. A special thanks to Dr. Bannon, Olivia, and T, who took fabulous care of a family member this week. Favorite things in Nashville? Relax Wraps. Their number is 615-872-0505. They're made in Nashville, Tennessee by Mama Sue, hubby Dan, and Brandon.
In every case, there is someone in the community who holds information that may be significant in solving a case. Relationships change over time, and many cold cases are solved when a former witness, friend, or relative is located who is tired of hiding information and shares that information with investigators. If you have any information about this case, please contact our voicemail comment line at 888-599-0008. You can leave an anonymous tip, or you can leave your contact information. We will call you back and speak with you directly. You can also email information to Sheila@SheilaWysocki.com. Without Warning, Executive Director, Executive Producer, and Host Sheila Wysocki. Announcer, Tim Evans.